This is a Pinball News production.
Okay, Centaur. I don't know how many people here have played Centaur. Okay, that's a good start. Centaur was a game that basically... it was a game I always wanted to make based on a game that my uncle had in his basement called Balls of Poppin'. It was a wooden leg game made about 1956. And it had a similar feature where all the balls would come out the side of the game and go into play, and it was just total chaos. So that was the start of the concept of the game of having virtual multi-ball. I mean, virtual multi-ball obviously was more equitable because since you did it in memory, whatever you achieved, you captured one ball, it stayed captured. The other player couldn't affect how many balls you had captured. So it just became a media. The electronics allowed for a media that made it, to me, a multiple player, one player game. Because a lot of these type of games that had these type of features were always one player games. This finally, by having the virtual multi-ball, allowed it to be something that could, everybody can enjoy. So I don't know where to start on this. We're talking about the design of Centaur, the concept of Centaur. Centaur originally was called Video Classic. And the reason it was called Video Classic was for the idea of attract modes. The video games at the time that were very popular all had, attract modes. When the games were not being played on the screen, you could see what the concept of the game was and how to play the game. And so it was like, I'm not ready to give up. I love pinball. And, so how can I incorporate some of the ideas that are now in videos and apply them to the pinball and try to play off of that? And that's where the, orb feature and chamber feature and bonus feature, all that came from. Because, when you touch the flipper button and you started that, attract mode, all the lights went off. It showed you where the different features were. And so that was, basically to try to get people to understand, the people who played video games and hadn't played pinball yet, try to explain to them in a very straightforward, simple way of, these are your main, features, and here's what you should be going after. So that's, that's the concept behind, the game and why it was called Video Classic. And then our whiteboards always had, code names. And so then that's where Paul came into play and came up with the artwork and the idea for the black and white theme. And there's a number of different things that went into the game. I mean, if you want to talk about the geek aspects of designing the game, at the time, the games were more or less, we were always on a very tight, short leash as far as expenses. And probably the biggest controlling factor on the expenses was the system. The system had, 16 coils, it had 40 switches, And I couldn't build this game within those constraints. There was just no way to achieve what I wanted to achieve with the ball trough and everything. I was like one or two switches over. I cheated every place I could. And the ball trough, for example, was mechanical. It was, the last ball that entered the trough closed the flap, so you didn't need any switches in there. It was, I think it was an engineering masterpiece. Herb Grable was an engineer who worked on that, and then Lenny Badin was another engineer who picked up and fine-tuned it. And out of all the mechanisms, I think that worked beautifully. But, you know, I didn't think this game ever was going to be made because I was getting a lot of resistance from the head of engineering that, you know, you had to take something out because, you know, you didn't have enough switches. I sat down and I came up with a software approach doing AND logic where the switches became three blades instead of two blades. And I sat down with the programmer and it was like, will you be able to identify this as a different entity? If both these make exactly at the same time, can we give them a different function? Yeah. So we wired up the game using a software approach. We built the whiteboard that way. And all of a sudden, I get a knock on the door, and here's the head of engineering going, you can't do that. And it's like, why? Well, you only can have some, well, why? You haven't changed electronics. You haven't changed anything. Why can't I do it? It works. Why can't I do it? And he got really angry and mad, and he just kind of walked off. He came back about 2 days later, and he goes, okay, you're not going to do it the way you have it, but here's a different approach. As long as I sacrifice one of the continuous duty coils, he could give me another strobe line, which allowed from that point forward for us to either have 40 or 48 switches. So that was the birth of the electronics and the ability to make Centaur. The ball trough and the mechanism underneath was another issue. All of a sudden, the balls weren't being ejected by the catapult mechanism that was below the playfield. And so we kept making a stronger and stronger coil, and the problem was getting worse, not better. And it was one of those things where it's like, this doesn't make any sense. So I put two balls down there. The mechanism, it could kick two balls out, no problem. I put three balls down there. It would kick three balls out at the same time, no problem. And it's like, okay, so it's not a matter of strength. You know, it isn't the mechanism, it isn't the coil, what's going on? We had another engineer, his name was Desi D. Purcell. The man was the mad scientist of all mad scientists. If you asked him what time it was, he told you how to build a watch. And so I was able to get Desi interested in the problem. He talked the head of engineering into buying him a high-speed camera. And so it was back at that time, I think it was a Polaroid type system where it was based on Polaroid film, high speed Polaroid film. So I think you only got, I don't know what it was, 30 seconds or something like that. That was it. It would just go zzzz, and that's all you had. And what was happening is the ball was actually getting launched into the top of the cage and getting wedged in between the two wires. And it was getting pinched, and it was not being allowed to be thrown down the trough. And that's why if you look at the game, you'll see that there's a little sheet metal part that's formed. And that became the entranceway for the trough. So those are some of the mechanical or engineering aspects that, you know, that we had to deal with. So let me let Paul talk to you about some of the artwork challenges.
I'm glad that we have the posters up here for me to refer to, but I've actually pulled the original painting out to bring to. This is the first time it's been out of the drawer since a little accident happened back when we had moved the pinball division. I'm going to see if I can put this on a chair. Yeah, we'd moved the from the pinball division over to the Midway building, and over Christmas one year, the heat went off and the pipes froze in the art department. There's a sprinkler system and so on. And our whole office got flooded. And, of course, in my great organizational manner, I had taken a lot of the original paintings out of a drawer and was going to put them in a flat file in my office, and I just had them stacked against the wall. Space Invaders, Playboy, Centaur, a few others. And with 3 inches of water on the floor, came back after Christmas and found out that those paintings were still sitting there in that water. So on the back of this painting it's been, the whole bottom edge was delaminated. That's about how much of the water got to, and then pulled the backing off. And luckily, I was able to kind of re-glue it and save it just for posterity. But it's not quite the same as it was when it was produced. But one thing you might notice just from looking at the painting and then looking at the poster over here is I actually had to do two separate backlasses. I mean, I painted the background for all the shades and highlights and all the painterly qualities of the piece. And we had the four-color process working for us at that point, which was fairly new. And then I also did a black line ink drawing, which is similar to what the playfield looks like, on top of it. So they were kind of married together. And then, of course, we dropped in the red accents on the logo and on the back of the circle in the background. But going back when Jim, we were talking about it tonight, and we were trying to remember how the black and white theme even came up. And, of course, I wanted to take credit for it, but then he reminded me of some of the collaboration. And Jim and I, when we worked on a game, Jim was very good at coming in and talking to us as he was working on a white wood, and he was very careful because there, you couldn't assume that a certain artist was going to work on a game until you were sure we're in the rotation where the artists were going to be assigned to it. But he would, you know, he'd come in and say, oh, I'm working on this white wood, and I think, you know, it looks like you might be the one that would work on it. And, you know, and he'd talk about his ideas with me. And as artists, we really appreciated that because it gave us a chance to think ahead, especially for a non-licensed theme. As artists, we love to do non-licensed games because we weren't so handcuffed by the licensor. So he would often come in and talk to us about it. I don't know if everybody knows, but Jim and I worked on Playboy together, and this was one of the most recent last game we think we did together too. But I really appreciated his approach to it because he really cared about not just how the game played, but how it looked. So the black and white theme, this was at a time when the industry was going through some problems. 1981, and the industry was struggling a little bit, and there were a lot of games going out in the marketplace and with short runs and game after game after game, and a lot of saturation. And all these games, everybody's trying to do bells and whistles and bright lights and bright colors. And so we kind of shared this concept. What if we just did a black and white game with just a few red accents on it? And, you know, he asked me, you know, could we pull that off? And I said, well, I think we could. And I think by contrast, it would be so different in a lineup of games that maybe by virtue of that, it would really be something special. Once I played the Whitewood of this game, it was a terrific game. And as he just explained to you, I didn't know half of what was going on in the back room and the development of the mechanics of that game. I just know this guy put in a lot of work. And Jim was notorious for... when his game hit the line, he wasn't down there having to do a lot of tweaking or a lot of, you know, making sure last-minute stuff. His stuff was solid. And this mechanism was like, I gave him a lot of credit for coming up with this development of this thing, and he gave credit to all his engineers. But he really wanted to get this thing working right because he thought it really made the game. And if you've ever played it, it's one of my favorite games. It's a game that I have in my home. I love it, you know, and it was fun to work on. My memory of the story behind Centaur, though, is it's not a real long story. It just is that the concept we came up with in terms of black and white was different, and by virtue of it being different, marketing thought it would, and they were pretty respectful of our opinions in the art part of it, and were supportive of it. Engineering was not thrilled with it. I mean, my good friend Norm Clark. He always liked red, white, and blue playfields and very colorful pieces. And so something like this was an erratic departure. And then Frank Braca, actually the head of our software engineering, the fellow that was telling Jim that there weren't enough switches, he just thought the guy was ugly and nobody'd want to play the game. So we had some resistance in-house. I remember getting chewed out. I was telling this to Jim, didn't even know about this, that at the time I was wearing a bunch of hats. I was department chairman for our pinball division. Also in Chicago, we had the slot machine division, which I was also responsible for. So I was traveling back and forth just to monitor the artists. And during that time, we had also started this major screen printing operation back in 1978 is when we got it off the ground. But it was still improving the entire time. And that was my responsibility as well, at least as far as the overseeing and the artistic part of it. I didn't have to stay there and run glasses or anything or print glasses, but certainly responsible in making sure it worked. That was all kind of going on at the same time. So when I painted and did the playfield for Centaur, I was working primarily at night. So, not many people got to even see the development of it because everybody was gone. Jim would always be around to see how it was coming. And I went down to one of the screen printing conventions near the end of the backlash. I should kind of back up for a second. When we did an artistic package for a game, we usually tried to give about 10 weeks or 8 to 10 weeks to do that piece from the time the game is released to the time we finish the artwork. There were different times that didn't always happen quite that way. And the sequence of the way we would do a game was we would design a backlash because that's the kind of the visual draw of the game. We'd design it, do a rendering of it, present that to marketing. If there was a licensor we had to present it to, that's what they would see. That would be the first thing we'd show to everybody, get everybody sort of excited about the visual package. And then after that, we would actually go right to the play field, and the cabinet would be done first, then the play field, then the plastics, and then we go back to do the backlash last, because that's the last thing you need to actually put on the game for manufacturing, but you certainly need the play field and the cabinet and the rest of it. So there was a logic to that. We always liked to design the play field, and everything else was supposed to kind of tie together with the play field, or with the backlash. So I was in the last stages of finishing the backlash. Things were, again, there was pressure at this time in this industry with, runs being shorter, expenses. Jim was kind of going into that. They were looking at ways they could cut costs just because bill of materials were getting so expensive. They weren't, these games, the profit margin was going down because there weren't the long runs. And I had the audacity to take off to go to a screen printing convention in Florida about near the end of this. And I remember I was so exhausted from working on this game for doing these nights. I remember getting a phone call in the middle of the night from Billy O'Donnell, who was the president of the pinball division. He said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm at the pinball, or at the silkscreen convention." He said, "Well, when's Centaur going to get done?" I said, "Well, it's almost done, you know." He said, "Well, get home as soon as you can and get right on it." So I kind of got my rear end chewed pretty good. But as it turned out, it was probably okay because I cut back, wrapped it up, and I really liked the game personally. It's one of my favorites. The play field, the challenge about this is where Norm and I butted heads a little bit because it's a tough play when you're just dealing with black and white, and that's the most elaborate play field I've ever done. I've done some pretty, as Norm would say, I did some pretty busy play fields, pretty detailed. But this one had to be designed such a way where just by the virtue of where the white areas were and the lighter areas that enhanced the features, kind of helped you see the geometry of the play, and then still had some very, elaborate interest in the rest of the piece that tied in with the backlash. So it was challenging, and that playfield took longer than most of the ones I had done just because it was mostly hand-drawn pen and ink work with not a lot of color screens to it, all just a few red and then a white screen and then the black line on top that finishes it off. But I'm pretty proud of the detail work on that. People that have followed my games and know that my games have corresponded with me saying they really appreciate the detail and the artwork. It may not be the best for the player sometimes, but I know Jim was talking, he said it really needed to be almost that sort of that chaotic, and when those balls start releasing all over the place, it's like, where in the heck are these balls coming from? It was really a very exciting moment. So in the play of the game. So that's my recollection of Centaur. There wasn't much more to it except, the theme. So many people thought, was I into S&M? Was I? And I didn't know what it was. So I'm a wrestling coach and an artist. So I didn't. So it was more. This is based on two things. I had the theme. Of the mythological centaur becoming a biomechanical kind of creature at the time, and that was kind of I'd already done the Space Invaders, which is sort of based on the alien characters and biomechanical H.R. Giger approach. So I was kind of infatuated with that. I'd actually offered this the concept to Kevin O'Connor for a different game that he was coming up with. He says, "I don't get it. I don't see how that would work. I don't see how that would look." And I said, "Okay, well then I'll hang on to that one for me for later." And here it was. I just kind of pulled it out of the. It wasn't because of the particular theme of the game or the play of the game. It was this thought I had that would be cool. But when we started talking about black and white, I thought it lent itself because of the leather aspects and the mechanical aspects. It would lend itself to a biomechanical kind of theme. So that's how the concept of the Centaur motorcycle combination came up. The female in this one, I'm a classic for borrowing people from my life. The girl that's in Centaur is actually a former student I had, and I had run into her, you know, years later, and asked her what she was doing, and she says, you know, when are you ever going to put me on a game? Because I had used one of my previous former student from probably 6 years out of high school, came back, and she was on one of my first pinball games called Knight Rider, which was a truck driver with a waitress on, and she was the waitress. And so that got around the school, you know, and as these sisters would talk, and well, Mr. Ferris has me on. If you don't know, I was a teacher before I was a commercial artist, and I have gone back into education currently. So it's a part of my life I really have enjoyed and loved. But obviously it got me some models, too. So that girl, and I've never really mentioned that before, so I'm paying homage to her for doing that. She modeled. She didn't have that outfit. It was pretty straightforward. Just a... That was all artwork, but and then the Centaur character that Frank Brock I thought was ugly. There's no one that really modeled for me for that. That had to come out of here. So, but there was no effort at S&M or, but certainly the coloration and some of the devices in it were prevalent in a lot of things at that time. In terms of Heavy Metal magazine, which is an art magazine that a lot of comic book artists would follow, and there were a lot of those kind of themes in it and stuff. So it really was more innocent than maybe people would want to believe, but it just worked graphically. That's usually what I was driven by most of my career has been, will it look good? You know, is it cool? Will it look good? So so that's sort of the underlying story. It's not as mystical or, as strange as some people may have thought, but that's at least... as I recall it, and if there's anything else, I'm not going to admit it. So, anything else you want to? And I know we're going to be curious if you guys have questions too. I'm going to give. Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
How long has it been still in Europe?
What's that?
How long has it been still in Europe?
You know, Jim would know that better than I would. We came back with it for a second model. So, and again, the sales kind of were skewed differently. I think at that time a little bit. Europe, I think, had fallen more than the States, if I remember right. Europe used to be half our sales.
Yeah, the market obviously was soft at the time, and I think that when you looked at the inventory that the different distributors had on hand, you know, they always want to wash out. They want to wash out their inventory before they go on to a new game because they feel that once they launch a new game, then everything else would just die in the vine. So there was a lot of pressure at the time to bring it back, you know, because they didn't really make enough of them, and it took a while for it to catch on. And that's when Centaur 2 came out. But as far as the mix, I don't remember. I don't remember that.
I'm not sure either. I know it tested real well. I remember that,
yeah.
And it held up. I mean, the mechanism, because that was always, I think, the concern that some people
right.
had.
It wasn't, well, obviously the reason that Centaur 2 was in the cabinet is because the other game that was in that cabinet didn't have the mechanical integrity
I had forgotten about that. Yeah, we were talking about this up here. It had nothing to do with Centaur, but there were times that we've had to be adaptable to things that happened with games, and one that Jim remembered was we had done an Evel Knievel pinball for the home market, and this might be general knowledge to a lot of people, but we had done all the artwork, the game was already ready to go, it was going to be sold by Montgomery Ward, and I think it was about 3 days before the release, Evel Knievel was in the papers for beating up his manager with a bat, a baseball bat, and so suddenly marketing said, this probably is not a good time to come out with an Evel Knievel game, so we suddenly did a whole new art package and didn't have any tie in with any famous person. We just did a game called Galaxy Ranger, and Kevin O'Connor, thank God he could work quickly, got that out, and we satisfied the contract, but without Evel Knievel.
So.
How about the sound? I remember that it had that beating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
Say It Again board. Yeah. It was,
the way the, you know, if you look at some of the successful games from the past, you could tell how well a player was doing without even looking at the game, just by the way the tempo of the sounds or the type of sounds were being played at the time. And so I think that was another aspect. Same thing again, it was video games did that beautifully. So it was another attempt to play off of what was being done in the successful games. So the sounds were, you know, obviously this is a dark, you know, it was a dark theme, you know, and the sounds, I think, you know, blended in perfectly with it. So, you know, that's the speech for that game. I remember scripting that. I sat on my the floor of the house with a jug of wine, and and it was one of those things where I just said, okay, and started play acting, and my wife thought I was absolutely crazy, and scribbled. That was one thing I wish I could have, but I couldn't find the original drawing that had all my scribbles and the spilled wine on it. I wish I could have found that. But no, it was a great game. It was a fun game. There was, you know, Paul is the, you know, one of the first to say, you know, I'm more of a heavy engineering type when it comes to designing a game. I just enjoy, you know, seeing things work. And there was there's a different twist feature that was already in there. The magnet that's up at the in front of the target that captures the ball. When the balls were being released, we had it timed like the kinetic balls. When one ball hits the one ball and the other ball takes off, we actually had that where you lock the ball. Ball would be kicked out from the trap, hit that ball, and you know the ball would take off. Well, it just became too difficult to do that. It had to be too precise because what happened more times than not is all the balls ended up on the magnet. And then all dropped at the same time. So it doesn't always work the way you envision it, but at least it's fun trying.
So. Yes?
The poster shows that he's got a tattoo on the original artwork.
Okay, that's good observation. The question was, on the poster, he's got a tattoo on his arm. I think, does it say Pinball Forever?
Pinball Forever.
That's how, when I sign autographs, I sign them that way, too, now. Yeah. But at that's the first time that ever was put in. This was remember, pinballs were struggling a little bit at this time. And the reason it's in that artwork is because, as I said, I did a separate ink drawing that was married with the painting. So the painting supplied the grays and the blending of the tones and everything, and then the line artwork, which is very much like the old way we used to do pinball art, which is almost like a coloring book, you know, and that's where the tattoo was in that screen, so that's why you don't see it there. But if I had brought the original black line, which I don't have anymore, I don't have the film for that. That was kind of kept in the archives with some other stuff. But I kept all my paintings, and as I said, this one hasn't even been out of the drawer because it was. I tried to, you know, save it as much as I could, put it in to make sure it stayed flat. And Space Invaders is the same way. It was delaminated pretty well, too. Playboy I was able to fix. There's like two others in there, too. So this when I knew I was going to be coming here tonight, I said, I wonder if I still have that back glass painting. I couldn't remember for sure. And I went back in, and luckily I found it. But so, yeah, a lot of little details were in there. It was basically to help enhance. We actually did use a black line. When we did even our four-color backlasses that were all full of color, we used a black line as well, just to deepen the contrast with the blacks, because when you backlight that glass, it tends to wash out color, especially four-color process doesn't have as much of a heavy laydown of the ink. So we had to develop this method of using a line art separate black screen when we did it. So you had a question, too, I know.
I'm just curious what's going on with their eyes.
Oh boy, that might have been a night of sniffing too much turpentine or something. I think I saw them as almost insect-like. I think if I remember right, that this was sort of, the painting was done first, as I said, and that kind of created the concept, and then the milieu of the playfield kind of had to evolve as I was doing it. You know, just to keep adding elements and that would look cool in black and white. But I remember I did a picture of her on there, and they're not sunglasses. It's definitely sort of more like a insect-like eye, or but again, sort of a mechanical aspect, not purely biological. You know.
That looks like the Borg.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, I never thought. I don't know if the Borg was a Borg around then. I don't. Yeah.
Mad Max.
I mean, there's nothing. What you realize when you're an artist is there's nothing original in art. It's just it just resurfaces in some way. So I've been influenced by things I wouldn't even know I've been influenced by. But yeah.
So that would be the challenge to remember. Do you remember how many screens there were in that backlash?
There should be. There is a. It's a good question. Now there's a four color process. So there are four colors: magenta, cyan, and yellow.
But no band.
What's that?
On this glass.
Yeah, on this one too. Let me think about this, because the gray had to be created from the halftone, though. So,
okay.
No, I beg your pardon. Now, that's a really good question. I have to think back now. I think we did run the just the black in a halftone, though. It looks like the painting. So there's a black screen like this. There's also a black solid screen, which is like the ink version combined. And we didn't have the other colors except we actually had. The red was not made of the four-color process red, because that would have taken three colors. So we just used a solid strip in of solid red. And it's brighter that way anyway. It's a pure color. So that's what we did. And then we have, I can't remember at this point, I think we had eliminated, did we still have our opaque screen at that
yeah.
point? Yeah. So then we always had a white and an opaque screen, which would allow tilt and game over and that those other things to come through when the light would shine behind it. Yeah.
So there's tiny amounts of cyan in there. Something.
No, this one.
I don't think this one was created that way.
It is just the gray, the black screen. But typically the black screen, we didn't use the. This goes back again to the earlier games, Lost World and Paragon, Playboy, some of those games. We didn't actually run a four color process black. We ran three colors, and then a solid black, because when we wanted it to be really black, we wanted it to be solid, heavy black. So it would be in a black line. So if you saw the painting for Playboy. I don't know if you're familiar with the first one, but it has a lot of pink and black elements in it in solid black that surround all the readouts and a little bit in the artwork itself, but mostly in the display and decorative borders and things, along with mirroring. But the black in that one is a separate solid black screen. We found that when we ran four-color process with all four colors like you would as a litho print, with the way screen printing is, you run a black print that's supposed to be all halftones and grays, and screen printing tends to gain in the size of the dots, and all of a sudden it gets real muddy and dark, and all your attempt to make it brilliant color is defeated. So that's why pretty early on we decided to go that way. It was unconventional, and it was kind of, I remember we were on the cover of Screen Print magazine back with Lost World because we were doing something different and pulling it off, you know. So we were kind of given some accolades for. Because in the business before that, they had never done that, you know. So that was how we pulled it off to make it work with a backlit piece, you know. Hope I answered all the questions. I see you've tested my memory, and that's again, if I've done interviews in the past, and I just want to make sure I'm not changing something I said earlier. So, yeah. But that's how I remember it. Yeah.
Was there any originally was a thought that the mirrors or Centaur like the new version that we just went out?
Oh, there is. I didn't know that. They put it on the.
The
mirrored. Did we do mirror on the Centaur 2? I'm trying to remember. Okay. And again, we would almost always, if possible, ask for mirroring. I mean, because mirroring was a sense of enhanced visuals. We thought sparkle. You know, and it didn't work with every piece, but it was fairly expensive. And so at this time, I know we were trying to pitch this that look, this is, okay, the theme's a little dark, but you know it's going to save us money in production. You know, that's one of the arguments we actually used, because we knew, and this goes back to even originally with the four color playfield art. I only cared about it because it was a chance to do paintings and to do airbrush and some of the things that illustrators and artists could do at the time where the old method wouldn't allow. But what really got Bally very interested in it, besides the marketing standpoint behind it, you went from 14 colors hand screened to four that were done on a press. So from 250 impressions an hour with the new system to 200 impressions a day with the old. So that was the amount of money that saved just in labor was very attractive to them. So, you know, I took advantage of their eagerness to do that, but I just thought it was a great thing to put on. It gave us so much more versatility as artists to what we could do. But there were some arguments, and it wasn't embraced by everybody in the beginning because four-color process as a process does not have the same brilliance in color or the same stained glass effect that, say, a pure spot color has. And so, you know, the artwork has to really be pretty powerful to make up for some of the, you know, if you're just fighting color for color. So.
Yes.
I can't help but know the two glasses are different. Why is that something that they do glasses?
The two glasses are different?
No, they're not. They weren't different in production. That was what you're looking at is a, it's this two-stage process to make the production glass. This is the first stage. The second stage is putting the other portion of so it's like a sandwich.
I see what you're saying.
So it's still this is only the first stage of the artwork. The second stage is the completion of it. It's the marrying of the two.
Oh, you know what? That's a good observation. This was on the glass though. This was on the glass. Okay. And that's interesting. I didn't even pick that up until now.
That's a poster.
What?
It's a poster.
Yeah. So when they created that, there may have been something I'm not remembering about the. I have to go look at my glass when I get
player,
home.
Yeah, the player guide was a little three.
Yeah. But I honestly can't remember now because it just I believe this was still in the glass. And if anybody has a Centaur at home, take a look. Yeah. We didn't again, but this is like I said, this is the first layer. As Jim was saying, there's a layer here, then there's a black line that goes over this, and then in the screening process, we add the reds. It's just a separate mechanical drop-in, rather than try to paint it out. Because if I paint it, it becomes a four-color red, and it's not as bright.
So we didn't have, I mean, we only made one glass. I mean, I think that there was a push at one time to do a color play field. I don't know if you actually ever completed that. I know you were being pushed to
like I said, this was every step of the way, you know, you're trying to, people were waiting to see if this would work, you know, and it, with that amount of detail on a play field, that, they were nervous about that. And again, you know, you don't want to. We didn't want to have a cookie cutter for every game, so it was always the same formula. We were willing to try, and they were pretty supportive, but they made us sort of earn it in terms of the concept. So we had to do pretty elaborate. I did a very elaborate sketch on that and showed it to them, and they could then see it. And it was smaller, but they could at least see it in terms of how it might work.
I have a question for Jim Padilla, designer extraordinaire.
Mm. You bet.
The last gig you did for the industry, I think it was fabulous. Thank you so much for that. Great gig.
Yeah, thank you.
But one feature I loved about that was the four inline drop targets.
Yep.
That was a pretty good receiver. I still love that feature. How'd they come from that?
I don't know how to answer that. That actually, I don't believe it was used in that game for the first time. I think that if you looked at that mechanism, had been used before. So, yes.
Maybe with the alien, the character.
What resemblance?
That's the first I've ever heard that. Do you think that the Centaur character looks like? Oh no. Oh, you're talking about Space Invaders, right? Are you? Wow. I mean, that's a story behind Centaur that I don't know. I know that's actually, that's interesting. I know what Giger looks like. I remember long curly hair is all I remember, but go ahead. That's interesting. It's just exactly the same as the girl on Paragon. Yeah. She dreads it. We have people calling all the time saying, you know, can I see the girl that's on Paragon? She's 65, you know. What's that? No, it's about maybe 16. I actually just retired 2 years ago. That's my passion. That was golf for me. I used to love to go in and wrestle. So a little bit crazy, but it's good. But she was everybody doesn't know the Paragon game. My wife was my model on that, and she's a great sport, but she won't do it anymore. So.
Yes.
Jim, for anything that was taken out of the game, if you were playing the game,
that's a good question.
Feature that you really wanted or something you wanted to do?
No, I don't think so. I think that the fight, you know, obviously to keep everything was accomplished by going to less expensive artwork, and, you know, in other words, we worked within the parameters. This is what we have to work within. Then, no, you don't get to take anything else away as long as we meet the goal. And we were allowed to do that. So, no. I think that, you know, there was a feature that never made it into the game, but it was really a one-of-a-kind trade show. And Centaur, when it was first shown, it had a dot matrix display in it, in the center. I don't know how many people know that. But it was a one of a kind game. I have the prototype at home, but I don't have the display. But if you look in the insert, I still have the cutout for where the display had been, and it was just a, you know, very crude attraction mower the Centaur rode across on his motorcycle. So he sent, you know, some graphics and stuff like that, but. Yes, that was never intended to be in the game because that was way too expensive, especially at the time.
One thing I do remember, based on your question, though, that made me think a little bit about the face of the guy on Centaur. I think I told you at one of our management meetings, Frank Bracca brought up they were questioning the black and white theme, and then the attractiveness of the people that are depicted on the game. And when I actually created his face, I was thinking sort of a horse-faced sort of guy, and if that's what Giger looks like, that's just a weird coincidence. But that was my inspiration, and then I got kind of resolute about not changing it once the concept was. I wanted him to be kind of beastly, you know, kind of a little bit of a monster. Kids now are into, you know, vampires and zombies, and so every generation has certain things that are appealing, and we tried to come up with things that were sort of appealing to that mostly male audience, we admit that. And
seems very happy with that
primitive. What's that?
It seems very happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pinball, you gotta be happy.
Pinball forever.
That's right. Yes.
In the game there's a phrase that you're using.
Mm-hmm.
Like the number of things on this feature.
Mm-hmm. But kind of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a subtle nudge to get you to understand that you didn't do it right.
Was it your idea to come up with the scrubbing play?
Yes. Yes.
Yep.
It accomplished two things. When it was out on, when the balls are ejected, obviously the play field goes dark. And it was to disguise the fact of where the balls were coming from. And it used to be great fun in a dark arcade to see somebody playing it and not having a clue where the balls came from. You know, it's like, I had a guy laying on the game watching, you know, and he still didn't figure it out. And, yeah, no, that was intentional.
One thing, at least two times, we offered it to the ball for a long time. Our biggest complaint is backlash. So we came up with a great idea to put a relay in the back box so when the game starts to turn the lights off.
Mm-hmm.
And with that game, it was particularly dramatic because it would go from strobing to fully lit.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay.
That's cool.
Really
dramatic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nice. It's really nice to turn the lights off because it would move the new ball.
Yeah.
What is doing that thought process of getting the reverse board?
Well, I would say the reason it wasn't used again was cost. You know, everything became, you know, that was right at the, you know, the critical point in, you know, trying to keep pinball alive was, you know, with the runs going shorter, they had to increase their profits, and it was just one of the last hurrahs, I think, as far as, you know, why it had to come out. But it was just, again, to add to the whole, the stage presence of the theme.
I have a question. In my opinion, I'm sure a lot of people probably agree that Centaur is not a problem. In my opinion, the best thing to write. Was there ever a rivalry
Oh, no. No, we were actually good buddies.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was, I think people, we had a pretty tight group. And Ward was a good player. And we used to have, you know, I think that, especially at that era, people who liked playing pinball and who were skilled at playing pinball viewed the designs differently and came up with different ideas, more challenging ideas, mechanically speaking.
So. I think you mentored him, too, to some degree, too, because he was an up-and-comer.
During game over on the Playstar, what, operator optimal every 15 minutes, ball would shoot out.
Yeah.
Pop up with the word,
mm-hmm.
Make up the word. First time I ever ran into that, I was playing a pinball machine next to and that happened, and it freaked me out.
Uh-huh.
Was that the desired effect?
No, the desired effect was to say, you know, come play me. You know, that was the desired effect. You know, what the hell happened? I got to go look at that. But to say that it, you know, it shocked you, my wife and I went out on a date, and we come home, and here's the babysitter. You could see a look of horror on her face, scared to death. You know, and it's like, what's wrong? There's somebody in the basement.
Yeah.
What? There's somebody in the basement. Did you go downstairs and play pinball? Yes. Did you turn the games off? No. Okay.
That's good. Well, they were happy with it. I mean, at that point, it was just he wanted to make sure it got out. And again, with these lead times were diminishing, so they didn't really know how much time we had before a game had to hit the line. And he knew I was actually going. He just had forgotten, and then realized that the only thing we have left to get on there is the glass. Is it done yet? And then he went back in the art department.
Paul made the deadline with lots of time to spare.
At least 30 seconds, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about the Playboy deadline.
Playboy was the worst, though. Yeah, that's right. Jim was
at the club? At the tournament?
I don't know if you guys know this story or not, but I'm not proud of it, but there's actually a marker that's exploded on the wall at Bally's art department for me in frustration not being able to get done. But I was at Bally headquarters in west side of Chicago, and there was a pinball tournament going on down at the Playboy building.
Playboy,
right?
Towers. Yeah.
Playboy Towers, when it was in Chicago. And we were supposed to present the Playboy game at the end of this tournament, unveil it, and it was sitting up on stage with the cover over the back glass area, and everything else was produced and ready to go. I was back at Bally markering to do a rendering of the back glass to be able to put it in. It was not going to be a screen. There was no time to do a screen, please. That wasn't my fault, but my fault was not having the rendering done quite as quickly as it should have been. So I remember calling Tom Neiman on the phone, said, I've got it, I'm coming in. So they had a trooper come to the door to kind of escort the piece in, and they got up there behind, underneath the cover that was the drapery that was over it. Jim was there, I'm just sweating bullets, and they had the Playmate of the Year there, and what's his name? Bill Murray was there, and Gilda Radner, and it was a big deal. Anyway, so 5 minutes before the unveiling, they're up behind the under the drapery, putting the back glass in, and then, you know, 5 minutes later they unveil it, and it's a big hit, and everybody likes it. And I was pretty tired. That was a day when you did, you know, work 3 nights in a row, 3 days in a row, you know, where you'd go after it. So that's why I'm really only 27 years old. I just look like this from from doing that.
That was one of my favorite deadlines.
No.
To wrap up, though, you know, you have to appreciate what they did for the time. There's so many firsts in that game, there's so many features. It was really a great piece. I thank you guys for being here to share this.
You're welcome.
Thank you all.